Alright everyone, this is going to be pretty fun. So we recently just had first year oral arguments. We call it FOIA for short. Pretty much what happens is that we have a brief that's due. We draft a brief for an appellate court to hear, to review, and then after we turn in our brief, we go ahead and we argue it as if it was in front of a panel of judges asking us questions. In other words, we are practicing both writing skills and we are practicing speaking skills. On Tuesday of last week and Thursday of last week, Monday we turned in the brief, Tuesday we did first rounds, and then Thursday we ended up doing second round of oral arguments, and ultimately we competed. I made it to semifinals, so that was pretty exciting, but it's also something that's a little nerve-wracking as well. The biggest consequence from that is that I have to participate again. That's going to be tomorrow night. And I figured this would be a good opportunity for me to practice, to go over my outline a couple of times just to see what's going to go on in the same format of a moot court setting. I also thought that this would be a good opportunity for anyone who wants to hear what an appellate argument might sound like a bit. They have that there as a reference. One thing to know is that these are based off of actual Supreme Court cases and actual circuit court cases, but the hypothetical fact pattern that we were given was fake. We're arguing this to the 14th Circuit, which is not an existing circuit, just because that way it fits our hypothetical fact pattern. But all the other case names that we are going to reference are going to be real. Anyways, the way that this works is I'm the appellant. That means that I will be arguing the on brief. My brief, which is the on brief. And ultimately trying to convince the court that what happened last time was wrong and that it should be reversed. In the trial court, what happened in the trial court was wrong. The appellant has 8 minutes to start, and then the appellee speaks for 10 minutes, and then the appellant reserves 2 minutes for rebuttal. So I know you can't really see how this looks or anything, but at least the verbal is here to get a good idea of how everything goes. So I'm going to go ahead, time myself, go through all the formalities, and do a practice round of how this looks, and hopefully review it afterwards without it being too cheesy. Alright, with that said, I'll just get into the mindset, and wish me luck. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is William Larson, and I represent the appellant, Blake Woodson, in this case. At this time, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Would the court appreciate a brief recitation of the facts? Today, this court should adopt the approach taken by the majority of circuits and reverse the district court's ruling by holding that newly presented evidence is allowed. And it should do so for the following reasons. First, the text in precedent cases state that the petitioner may show new evidence that was not presented at trial. Second, the intent of the Supreme Court is interpreted broadly to allow new evidence. Third, there is a greater interest in avoiding a miscarriage of justice than there is in the finality of a sentence. And then, finally, even if the court decides not to adopt a completely broad approach, they should allow for an exception to where newly presented evidence may be adopted if it was excluded due to ineffective counsel. Let's go ahead and hop into these arguments one by one. Alrighty. Also, one thing I should note before starting over is that this is something that I'm actually not the most comfortable with. I did all right during the rounds, but it's something I definitely consider to be a weakness and want to be an improvement. So I may work through this a couple of times before I make it through all my arguments. And again, I'm a bit rusty. It was a week since I argued my side. I'm going to go ahead and start again. Thanks for your patience. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is William Larson, and I represent the appellant, Blake Woodson, in this case. At this time, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Would the court like a brief recitation of the facts? Today, this court should adopt the approach taken by the majority of circuits and reverse the district court's holding by holding that newly presented evidence is defined as new reliable evidence, and it should do so for the following 3 reasons. First, the text in the precedent cases states that a petitioner may show evidence that is not presented at trial. Second, the intent of the Supreme Court is to broadly include new evidence. Third, there is a greater interest in avoiding a miscarriage of justice than there is in the finality of a sentence. For these 3 reasons, the court should reverse. However, if the court determines not to interpret evidence completely broadly, they should allow an exception to where new evidence can be permitted if it was withheld due to ineffective counsel. So first, the text in precedent cases states that a petitioner may show evidence that was not presented at trial. This is seen as the plain language of the text. In Schlepp, it says that a habeas petitioner needs to present new reliable evidence, whether it be exculpatory scientific evidence, trustworthy eyewitness accounts, or critical physical evidence that was not presented at trial. That first part of the phrase, new reliable evidence, says what is required, but then that last part says what the scope of this definition is, and it says that is not presented at trial. This is a plain meaning view. The Supreme Court says this phrase multiple times in its majority opinion, and several circuits have adopted this approach, this plain meaning view, without any question. This includes the Second and the Sixth Circuit, where they read the definition word for word from the Supreme Court and apply directly to its facts, allowing newly presented evidence. Additionally, even if this plain language is not completely present, as is the case in Griffin, Griffin still adopted a broad interpretation by looking at other parts of the text. If you look at other parts of the text, it says that new reliable evidence can include evidence that was either excluded or unavailable at trial. We have here multiple ways that evidence can be included, either excluded, which means it was unavailable but not presented, or unavailable, which means the newly discovered view. Both options are present and available. Third, the Supreme Court did not explicitly deny new evidence to be newly presented evidence. In Herrera, the Supreme Court specifically said that new discovered evidence was required for a factual innocence claim. Here we have an actual innocence claim, which says that evidence must not have been presented at trial. Because of this distinction and this omission, it should not be overlapped, according to Gomez. Second, if we look at the intent of the Supreme Court, it is to broadly allow new evidence. Schlepp was broad, allowing new reliable evidence to overcome procedural bars so that a petitioner can access through the actual innocence gateway. House was broad as well, saying that all evidence, old and new, should be allowed to overcome a procedural bar. McQuiggan was also broad. Both of these cases, House and McQuiggan, came after Schlepp, and McQuiggan allowed new reliable evidence to overcome a statutory bar as well, as is the case here. It makes sense that the Supreme Court would not create a broad rule, but then narrowed that rule with a narrow restriction on new reliable evidence. It may be argued that the O'Connor concurrence defines new reliable evidence as new discoverable evidence. However, House and McQuiggan followed the Schlepp opinion, and because both of those opinions were broad and was not clarified any further, the O'Connor concurrence is only seen to help dissuade the dissent's opinion. Third, there is a greater interest in avoiding a miscarriage of justice than there is in the finality of a sentence. The Supreme Court recognizes that there is an interest here, and there is an interest to both the finality of a sentence and the miscarriage of justice. However, the Supreme Court rules significantly in favor of avoiding a miscarriage of justice. The biggest part of this is because the finality of a sentence here is something that even though the Supreme Court wants to consider, they do not want to convict even one innocent person. And the Supreme Court says that they would rather let 100 guilty people go free than to convict one innocent person. Additionally, this will not flood the system with unmeritous claims. According to Fontenot and according to Gomez, petitioners are not allowed to repack material. Evidence occurs in the most extraordinary of circumstances and is unavailable most of the time, according to Schlepp. That means that petitioners are not able to say, oh, I didn't present my material in the past, and as a result, I can present that material now, meaning my testimony. I didn't go up on trial. I should go up on trial now. No, petitioners are not allowed to say that I did not do this properly, and as a result, I can have this happen again. For those reasons, the court should reverse. However, if the court decides not to reverse completely and decides to take a more narrow approach, it should still allow an exception for evidence to be included if it was withheld due to ineffective counsel. A narrow approach is too harsh on the petitioner who has very little control in the sentence. This is the case in Hoke and Gomez, where it recognized both an opportunity to allow evidence that was excluded due to ineffective counsel. Hoke is an interesting case, too. The Third Circuit originally adopted a completely narrow approach. However, in Hoke, it realized that that was a harsh exception, and as a result, eased it for petitioners so that they would not be treated unjustly due to ineffective counsel. This has deteriorated even more, where Hoke has said that due diligence isn't even required, and now all you have to do is have reasonable diligence to determine whether or not ineffective counsel was present. As a result, the circuit majorities agree that new reliable evidence should be the case, and for the following reasons, this court should reverse. First, because the text in Schlepp argues, I see my time has expired. Can I briefly conclude? Your Honors, this court should reverse for the following reasons. First, the text. Second, the intent of the Supreme Court. And third, because of the policy reasons of the Supreme Court. Thank you. All right, everyone. That was just a quick run through. Not my best go. I'm going to go a few more times. That was my first run through today. I'll probably do the other couple off of microphone just to have that experience without anybody listening. Run through things. Simulate a couple of questions being asked in the middle of it. That way I can have the best opportunity to practice and learn. Thank you for your time. One last thing to note before going is I am a little bit behind with updating my outlines as well as doing the other podcast episodes for all the doctrinal classes, and a big reason for that was because the brief was due on Monday of last week, and the FOIA that was on Tuesday and Thursday. My goal is to be completely caught up this week. If not, then next week is spring break, and so I will have a little bit of time between these next 2 weeks to completely finish up with catching up. That way, all the material will be up there for review if anybody wants to continue to learn. Thank you. Have a good one. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro. And you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice, and with that, the fourth thing is if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.